number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
All right, then. It is 15 hours UTC, Tuesday, October the 29th, in the glorious future year of 2024. Now, what do I have for you today? Well, I recently came back from Europe, and when I was preparing to travel to Europe, I had dug out my copy of Analog Magazine with the first appearance of Harry Harrison's story, A Transatlantic Tunnel, Hurrah! This was, of course, the trip on which I attempted to travel as far as possible without any air legs. Of course, this was limited because you really don't have much in the way of transatlantic options other than by air these days. I was traveling part of the way, of course, with a friend who can be said does not suffer from a fear of flying. She actually trained to be a aircraft pilot, but no more than me, or perhaps even less than me, which is difficult. She does not relish scheduled commercial air travel, which is a thing in and of itself, and which I just always say, if you abbreviate it by the first letters of the phrase, you get a pretty good explanation of what it's like. But, let's see. Now, while I was picking this up, I realized that the first issue, so Transatlantic Tunnel Hurrah is spread out over three issues of Analog, serialized, and the first issue in which it appears is April 1972, and that issue has the second part of a two-part science fact article on Skylab. Now, that's very interesting to me. And so what I thought I would do is to go back and dig out the March 72 issue also, and then read you this article on Skylab. And what I may do at some point is go back and dig through it and pull out the issues where the first appearances of some very famous science fiction stories are, Anne McCaffrey's We're Search, for example, or Frank Herbert's Dune, and read the science fact articles that appeared in those publications. Oh. Got a good crowd in comm today. We've got Gemlog in British Columbia and Tin from Berlin. There's quite a few time zones in between them. Yes, $6 per year in the USA, 60 cents per copy. Ben Bova, editor. But yes, let's we'll turn here. Well, let's see if see what Ben Bova has to say. prison today... The prison system today is a classic example of saying one thing while meaning another. For example, we all know that prisons are meant for criminals. When a man or woman breaks the law, he or she is apprehended by the police, tried by a jury of peers, and sentenced to a prison term when found guilty. Oh yeah? Most of the real criminals in the country have seldom, if ever, seen the inside of a jail. These are the professionals, the people who make illegal activities their life's work. Professional men are marked by certain standards, no matter what the profession. They strive for a high degree of quality in their work, and they frown on shoddy, sloppy performances. They don't tolerate freelancers gladly and do their best to get rid of them. Medical doctors frown on chiropractors. Scientists loathe directives from politicians. Professional people also band together in professional organizations, which serve to further the aims of their chosen field of endeavor. The American Medical Association, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, and the Mafia are three examples of such organizations. But yes, folks in Europe are no longer on summertime. Ratshu is happy at being in UTC. I was in UTC when I was in Iceland. They don't change the time, which is funny. And for how far north they are, time changes are usually justified by saying, well, you know, the seasonal alterations, well... Iceland has more of them than almost any country, but seasons are more drastically different there in Iceland than almost any other country, but they don't think it's worth it to jack their clocks back and forth twice a year. So, Skylab by Joseph Green. Starts with this blurb. With the Salyut space station, the Russians have once again beaten the United States to a first in space. The tragic deaths of the three cosmonauts overshadowed the technological success they achieved, but the United States program will be, as usual, bigger and better. That was a hideous accident in which the first Salyut crew returning to Earth, a pressure relief valve popped during their descent, and they suffocated. So, page 100 is a diagram reproduced from a NASA lithograph. Bonnie Astromunk died July 6, 1969. Bonnie died from heart failure, a common death brought on by a unique condition, weightlessness. Bonnie was a 14-pound macaque monkey, the primary passenger in the BioSatellite 3 capsule. The mission was terminated after 8.5 days of a planned 3-week mission because telemetry indicated Bonnie was seriously ill, afflicted by such unusual troubles as loss of circadian rhythm, rapid changes from one to another of the 4 normal levels of sleep, and pendular eye movement, abnormal swinging from side to side. The monkey's balance system seemed out of order. He lost 20% of his body weight. His heart rate dropped rapidly, and his brain temperature fell 5 degrees. He lived only a few hours after his capsule re-entered the atmosphere and was recovered. Commander Adrian G. Nikolaev and flight engineer Vitaly Sevastyanov did not die after establishing a record flight of 18 days in space in June of 1970, but both men lost weight, had difficulty adjusting to gravity after returning to Earth, and encountered physiological problems with calcium balance, bone deterioration, and other slowly accumulating ills. Similar problems had appeared as early as 1965 in a less severe form in the 14-day flight of Frank Borman and James Lovell in Gemini 7. Some scientists now speculate that the problems associated with weightlessness may be more subtle and less dramatic than anticipated, but still troublesome. Until these questions are resolved, flights to Mars that would require men to live under weightless conditions for many months would not be safe. Fortunately, the United States already has a program in work where the long-term effects of weightlessness will be thoroughly investigated. It is called Skylab, and the major item of hardware is the forerunner of the larger modular space stations planned for later in the decade. Well, I would hope that, Tin, your German is better than your Spanish, considering that you live in Germany rather than Spain. Figure 1 is captioned, "Complete Skylab with most of upper floor in OWS hydrogen tank cut away to reveal crew quarters on bottom level. OWS for Orbital Workshop. Note battery modules and tanks of breathable gases on exterior of AM, airlock module, large radiator above radial docking port on MDA, it's multiple docking adapter. Skylab began as the Apollo Applications Program, with the intent of utilizing Apollo program knowledge and equipment to obtain new scientific data, primarily by an intensive above-the-atmosphere study of the Sun. The original aims have not changed, but new experiments and studies have been added until, with the name changed to Skylab, the program is now equally a study of men living and working under weightless conditions." And then there's a picture of a Saturn 1B rocket on the ludicrous adapter known to many people as the milking stool, which was used to allow launching Saturn 1Bs from Launch Complex 39 rather than Launch Complex 37, where they were originally launched from. And it says, "Figure 2, artist composite of Saturn 1B on Saturn V mobile launcher sitting on Saturn V launch pad. The 128-foot steel pedestal under the 1B is built over the normal flame exhaust passage in the mobile launcher deck. Note white room at end of upper service arm where astronauts are helped into spacecraft by special button-up crews." I've never understood the deactivation of Launch Complex 37, which was used for the first manned Apollo missions, because they knew that they intended to keep flying Saturn 1Bs as well as Saturn 5s. It's a mystery to me. Skylab 1 will be launched from the Kennedy Space Center in the latter half of 1972, lifted by a giant Saturn V rocket. This vehicle will be 31 feet shorter and approximately 175,000 pounds lighter at liftoff than the one carrying astronauts to the moon, and it will be unmanned. After liftoff, the Saturn will head downrange at an inclination from the equator of approximately 50 degrees, roughly parallel to the eastern U.S. coastline. When the first stage engines cut off, after the usual 2.5-minute burn, the vehicle will be moving somewhat faster than the normal 6,000 miles per hour. The second stage will ignite and carry itself and the S-4B third stage into a 235 nautical mile circular orbit. This feat is possible because of the overall reduction in weight. Normally, the third stage must burn its single rocket to achieve orbit, but on this flight, that is not possible. The S-4B has no engine. The inert third stage will bear little resemblance to an S-4B on a moon mission. Three new items of hardware have replaced the command service module and the lunar module. An airlock module extends outward from the top of the stage's hydrogen tank. It connects to a larger cylinder called the multiple docking adapter, and ahead of the MDA, held in place and supported by a framework of aluminum tubing, will be the most complex astronomical tool ever launched into space, the Apollo Telescope Mount. The instrument unit, the automatic pilot for Saturn vehicles, will have several hours of life left and many duties to perform. It will activate two new cold gas jet rocket clusters, called the Thrust Attitude Control System, near the base of the third stage. These will orient the vehicle to a solar inertial attitude where the Skylab's short axis will always face the sun. It will then deploy two large arrays of solar cell panels attached to the sides of the stage, and raise an aluminum micrometeoroid shield that extends the length of the hydrogen tank. Its next task is to swing the ATM from its position ahead of the MDA, pivoting it on a hinge arrangement on the tubing framework until it locks in place at a 90-degree angle facing the sun. From tanks attached to the exterior of the AM, the instrument unit will fill all three modules with a 5-pound-per-square-inch gauge atmosphere comprised of 3.7 PSIG oxygen and 1.3 PSIG nitrogen. So that's about one-third of a standard atmosphere. Call it 35 kilopascals. Roughly 25 kPa oxygen, 10 kPa nitrogen. It also performs many smaller tasks designed to prepare the interior for human habitation. The complete assembly, in its working configuration, is called the Saturn Workshop. The third stage alone is called the Orbiting Workshop. See Figure 1 for orbital configuration. When the Apollo spacecraft is docked to the MDA, as shown here, the complete unit is called the Cluster, or Skylab. The laboratory is ready for the arrival of its crew. Approximately 24 hours after the liftoff of the Saturn V, a new type of launch will occur at the Kennedy Space Center. A Saturn 1B vehicle, Skylab 2, with a manned Apollo spacecraft as its payload, will lift off Pad B at the Saturn V facility, Launch Complex 39. In order to launch a 1B with Saturn V equipment, some major modifications are necessary, and they are illustrated in Figure 2. A pedestal, 128 feet tall, must be built on the base of the mobile launcher in order for the upper service arms to provide access to the spaceship and vital portions of the vehicle. Many other modifications must be made in the ground propellant supply systems, electrical connections, hold-down arms, etc. But the end result is a capability to launch 1Bs on a Saturn V pad, making it possible to close down the Saturn 1B launch pads 34 and 37 on Cape Kennedy. People talking about learning languages in COM, and all I'm thinking is, you know, Gemlog says he wants to Polish his Spanish, or Spanish is Polish, I'm not sure which. Figure 3 is a drawing. The astronauts at work. Man at left, above airlock to waste storage compartment in liquid oxygen tank below, carries air sampler. Center man is in wardroom preparing food. Note window to space behind him. Man at right is working at table designed to hold objects down by gentle flow of air through table and out bottom. I will, of course, point out that the sequence of events described in this article did not happen as planned, owing to the fact that the shroud of the Skylab spacecraft disintegrated during launch, damaging the spacecraft. The astronauts will rendezvous with the SWS and lock to the axial port of the MDA, completing the Skylab configuration. Ground control will have thoroughly checked the condition of the SWS by telemetry. The three astronauts can remove the seal in the docking port and enter the MDA without wearing spacesuits. After a visual check of what will be their home for the next 28 days, the astronauts will deactivate most of the systems on the command and service module, placing it in a semi-quiescent mode. After checking out and starting those support systems not under the control of the instrument unit, they will begin 4 weeks of intensive work. At the end of that time, they will prepare the SWS for orbital storage, re-enter their CSM, and return to Earth in the established Apollo manner, splashing down in the West Atlantic. Assuming no unexpected complications develop with the first crew, Skylab launches 3 and 4 will return two crews of three astronauts each to the SWS at approximately 90-day intervals spaced from the first launch. All crews will operate the ATM and perform a variety of other experiments, though the first crew's primary mission will be the medical experiments, the second crew will concentrate on the ATM, and the third on the Earth Resources Experiments package in the MDA. Both latter crews are programmed for stays of 56 days, with splashdown planned for the Central Pacific. Although in the event, the third cruise stay was extended considerably, largely through the use of basically Nutrigrain bars, because their limiting factor was the food on board, and so a bunch of extra food was set up with them, but only in a sort of compact form. The total Skylab, including the docked CSM, contains approximately 13,000 cubic feet of space, equivalent to that in a normal three-bedroom house. It has an overall length of 117 feet and a total weight on Earth of 165,000 pounds. Despite its comparatively large size, Skylab is not, by NASA definition, a true space station. According to NASA criteria, a space station must be able to operate indefinitely, and Skylab has an operational life of 8 or 9 months and an expected orbital life of something over a year. In order to operate indefinitely, a space station must be capable of accepting new supplies of water, oxygen, and other consumables. Skylab has all its consumables aboard at launch, and resupply would be difficult. There are no provisions for pumping more oxygen into the pressurized tanks, etc. In fact, you look at Skylab, and then you look back at studies done in the mid-60s on orbital missions to Venus and Mars, in other words, manned missions to Venus and Mars without landing, and you realize the Skylab configuration is essentially